Hello, everyone, and welcome back to No Direction Beyond, your Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm your host, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Alexander Agunis, the Everyman Gamer.
Yes, and James has been trapped in the drift for this episode, so he will be unable to join us, but do not worry, we have every expectation to have him back next time. And James, wherever you're going, please make your way back safely and with the minimal of planar corruption. Alex, how's your week been?
It's actually been pretty good. I put out a big Starfinder product last week, so
Yes. I know this was typically shout-outs, but this is a big project you've been working on for a while now. Why don't you tell me something about it?
Yeah, so I've been working on a product called the Advanced Skill Guide. The idea is that it revolutionizes how you use skills in Starfinder. Basically, there are sections that are devoted to taking different aspects of how skills work and just kind of broadening and expanding them. Chapter one is mostly based on leadership. So like you can recruit followers and cohorts and they can do stuff for you and it's all listed out and hey, you don't need a feat to do it. It's pretty sweet. There's a section that you could basically describe as how well do people know me? And that particular section is like, you know, reputation rules, relationship rules. There's a secret identity section that I think is pretty sweet. It helps you like kind of establish vigilante style secret identities and anybody can do it as long as you have the time and the know-how. There's a giant chapter that's like almost 100 pages long on how to build skill challenges, which are basically skill focused encounters that rely on your skill ranks rather than like your attack abilities and bonuses. So it's based on the work I did for Pathfinder in my skill challenge handbook product for Pathfinder. And instead of using all of that, it's completely relayed out for readability and for like referencing. So in the original skill challenge handbook, almost all of the rules for how to build skill challenges were in the very first chapter, which was like 60 pages long. And then like every other section after that was like somewhere between 10 to 20. And it was just one specific alternate type of skill challenge. And the one of the big pieces of feedback that I got was that it was really difficult to like read and know where to go. So everything has been broken up into like nice little headers. If you want to do a skill challenge with opposition, that has its own section. If you want to do a skill challenge that has you using a bunch of different special qualities, that has a section. The rules for creating skill challenges have been combined for like all types and put into one section. It's a much easier to read. I really, really like how easy it is to reference this time around.
Yeah. I was a big fan of your first skill challenge handbook, so I was really glad to hear that you were adapting it for Starfinder. I have not gotten my hands on a copy yet, but I do intend to raid the folder and look at it. So what made you decide to do this project anyway? Why broaden the skills?
When I did the skill challenge handbook for Pathfinder, it sort of opened up all of these different types of stories that you couldn't tell in base Starfinder that you can now tell are in base Pathfinder that are just now available, because not every adventure you go on is like this big epic, you know, punch 'em, beat 'em up. And the baseline rules don't do a good job of building encounters out of skills. It's just usually a couple skill checks and then you're done. It's really anticlimactic. And if you build into skills, it doesn't necessarily make you feel like your skills are worthwhile and worth the investment. So really the whole purpose of the entire book, everything from skill challenges to like the giant chapter on player options that's in the book at the back, it's all based on trying to make sure that when you decide that you want to be good at a skill, like your choices are meaningful and matter in the game.
And speaking of the player options in the back of the book, that brings us to today's topic. When Starfinder was announced, it was announced that it would launch with an Adventure Path line and a hardcover line and also a Pawns line and some maps, and there was some miniatures that were kind of in limbo, and we still don't quite know what's up with the miniatures because Ninja Division has delivered some of the miniatures, but they're still in production. There's been just a lot of fun stuff announced for Starfinder. But one of the things that was obviously missing in the schedule is there was no mention of anything that wasn't a hardcover or an adventure path releasing. So no player's companion line, no campaign setting line. Those are the two lines that we're used to for Paizo's Pathfinder publishing. And of course, we, being fans, we love to have content. And it's fair to say that the Starfinder fans, we have been a little bit content starved over its life cycle. And so their initial pitch was that, well, you know how adventure paths have things in the back? Well, we're going to repurpose that section and sort of make it like that's where our player companion type and campaign setting type material will appear. It'll be like the old Dungeon and Dragon magazine days. So you've got your adventure in the front and then your expansion content in the back, and that will fill the gap, badum-tish, between that'll fill the gap between hardcover releases. And so we're going to examine how that's exactly worked out now that we've had a adventure path go from start to completion. So we are going to look at the Dead Sun's adventure path, but not the adventure itself. We're purely going to take a look at the back matter and see, does the back matter really matter? Does it serve its purpose?
Right. So if you are running Dead Suns, there will not be much of a chance of spoilers unless like a monster we talk about appears in the AP, but I don't think that's the same as spoiling plot, so you should be pretty good to listen to this, even if you're in Dead Suns. Like, James and I are still in book two, or no, we just finished book four. We just
Right.
got done book four, yeah. And so like there's some stuff in these books that like I haven't like seen in context. If it appears in context, that's something else that we're probably gonna talk about when it comes to these volumes. But generally speaking, you should be okay. You don't have to run away from this video if you're in the middle of Dead Suns. You're good. We're just going over like the crunchy bits for players and GMs that aren't adventure related.
Right. Now, I do imagine that, well, we're going to get into that some when we do talk about the content, because it's going to be impossible to talk about this content without contrasting it against the adventure path for Pathfinder and how they've presented the back matter content.
Absolutely.
Because if this isn't substantially different than that, then they're really not giving us what what was advertised on the cover doesn't quite match the interior, if that makes sense. If we're only getting the same stuff we always got, then it really isn't anything special here. So it would definitely be a lack of content, not additional content. And that's super important to keep in mind because these Adventure Path volumes are shorter than the Pathfinder Adventure Path volumes
They are.
by a third. They're 64-page books, and the Pathfinder Adventure Paths up till this point have been 96-page volumes. So while that's already been felt by players of these adventure paths because they do feel shorter, reading through them
Oh, they do.
and playing through them, then if there's less material for the adventure part of the adventure path, then what does that mean for the back matter? How much
Well,
restricted is that?
let me preface by saying that as somebody who's officially completed four books of this adventure path, the shortened length of the adventures, I actually really like it. There's something really satisfying about getting to the end of the book and knowing like you have this accomplishment, and having the books run a little bit faster, just it sort of makes it feel like you're moving at a good pace. Like when we were doing Reign of Winter, there would be like times where we would go for like 3 months before we got done a book. And that happens in Strange Aeons too. Like it's a lot. Like, and most of these books haven't run much longer than like 12 to 16 hours tops. So like, I actually really appreciate how much faster they are. I do wish that they were a bit longer though. But before we get into that, why don't we start with the first volume of Dead Suns
All
that we could
right.
look at?
All right,
That
so the first volume of Dead Suns is Incident at Absalom Station. This was written by Robert G. McCreary.
Indeed.
And let's look at the contributors, which is a whole bunch of people. Holy crap. Okay,
Yeah, it's a lot.
a lot of people. So I actually don't know who worked on the back matter on this. We will have to corner the design team and ask them later, or the AP team and ask
So
them later.
I know that in modern APs, Jason Keeley is one of their AP developers. I would imagine that of them, like probably it was Jason and I'd say probably Robert, if I had to guess. It feels weird to be developing your own adventure, but like at the same time, I feel like of that list, it was probably some combination of Jason, Robert, and maybe Sutter.
Well, I don't want to take any guesses because I don't want to offend any artist or misattribute any artist or developer or creative that would have worked on this with any guesses on their part. So until we know, we will know. So how the back matter for this one opens up with a 2-page spread of Absalom Station, which is appropriate because not so much spoilers that this is where the adventure opens. And it's also the most important location in Starfinder, and I think that I can say that without any reservations. Would you agree?
Oh, totally. Absalom Station is so important that when you're a third-party publisher trying to design your own campaign setting, you have to figure out a way to reference Absalom Station without violating IP rights, because Absalom Station is literally at the center of the universe in the setting. And that's mostly because of the fact that the Starstone is there. And when you do drift travel functions differently if you're heading towards the Starstone. So
You're always
it's
like
super
what, one
important.
jump away from Absalom Station, no matter where you're at?
Yeah, no matter how far away you are, it's 1d6. I think it's 1d6 days, no matter how far away you are. Where like if you're in the Vast going from point to point, like you could be looking at weeks. But like it's never more than a week to get to the Starstone just because it's such a powerful beacon, it's easy to lock onto. But without talking too much more about that, when you start in, it's actually I would call this the proto Absalom Station chapter from Pack Worlds. Like this is sort of like what sets that whole chapter up and gives it its like base footing.
It's a 10-page section. Starts off with that beautiful double page spread, which really lets you know feel like what it is like on the station, including a lot of like you have the big wide station sweep shot profile, and then you have a whole lot of labeled what would be half pagers, just little thumbnails of half page art to let you see what life on the streets are going to be like Jatimbe Park, the Spike, the Planara, Fog Town, the Arms, the Armada. Wait, this is all the locations you go to in the first Pathfinder Society adventure.
Hey, look at that. You figured it out.
Oh, don't, don't, don't. And then you get a 10-page, what do they call those again? And it was right on the tip of my tongue. Good Lord.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
A 10-page gazetteer on the station itself. So it
Yeah,
talks a
yeah.
lot about the origin and the history of Absalom Station, which it amounts to a big giant vagina.
Yeah, basically.
How the government works, what resources it has, the typical society breakdown. Like, if you're familiar with Absalom Station, a lot of what we know about it was started here. And while this information will get expanded in the Pact Worlds chapter for Absalom Station, this is still if you don't have access to that book, this is still a good way to read up on it. And this would make a great printout for any players that you wanted to have in any sort of Starfinder campaign, honestly, because of how important this station is.
You know what's interesting? I never noticed the population of Absalom Station, according to this gazetteer, is only just shy of 2 million people. I don't. I thought it was like bigger than that, and there were more.
I mean, they say it's what 50 miles to a side and just as tall, and so even though it has like a whole bunch of decks and a lot of them are empty, I mean, that's not a lot of space. I mean, that's smaller than New York City, and that's only and that's several million people there, but 2 million seems like a good fit for this.
Doesn't New York City have close to 10 million people, though?
Yeah, over 10 million people. I'm really not sure on the exacts on that, but I know it's more. And I'm going to Google that so that we don't have any corrections sent in to us or people yelling at it. It's actually New York State is 19.5 million. The city itself is only 8.6 million.
I demand that we take 6 million more people and we shove them into the space station to see if it falls from orbit.
Even Tokyo is just shy of 10 million, so darn it.
Oh, you're not going to ignore me on that, are you? My crazy super science plan?
I was really hoping that we wouldn't commit accidental genocide, so I was kind of trying to skip past it. Because I'm pretty sure most of those abandoned station areas aren't safe anymore.
Aren't they filled with monsters?
A lot of them are filled with monsters, if the adventures that I've played through in society have taught me anything.
Listen, if you go to any place on a space station, there's at least a random encounter table's chance that there are monsters there.
Yeah, I mean, why do we pack monsters on the space stations anyway? I mean, didn't the Alien movie ever teach us anything?
Maybe it was like a zoo for like monsters, and then the gap happened and it all short circuited, and like maybe the population was closer to 8 million and just 6 million of those people just got eaten. That's why there are no races from Galarian besides like humans and Yosoki on that ship. They all just got devoured by these space monsters.
And Cryptrocker corrects me, thank you Cryptrocker, that it's only 5 miles to Asad.
That makes more sense then.
So yeah, much more tinier, and 50 would be huge. So, thank you, Crypt, and welcome back to the audience. If you guys have any questions during the show, please ask us. We will do our best to answer them. And we're going to have to move through these at a pretty big clip, because if we're going to spend a lot of time on each section, this would be much longer than the hour that we allocate for a No Direction broadcast. Direction Beyond broadcast. No Direction gets to go for like 3 hours.
Before we go, did you see this hilarious picture of this Yosoki eating his sword for some reason?
I thought he was just, like, picking his teeth.
No, he's clearly eating his sword. He needs more fiber.
But that doesn't work. That's not fiber.
It's outer space. It's fine. He's got adamantium teeth and disintegrator acid stomach juice. I don't know.
All right. Okay, fine. It works. All
right. Well, you know, I'm sure you know, Perrin, but Absalom Station isn't the only relic of Galarian currently in the setting, is it?
No. And they detail several of them in the next section, aptly called Relics of Galarian.
When you read this section, like, if you're a Pathfinder fan, this is basically the author just nudge, nudge, wink, winking you the entire time.
I know. This was basically what I considered to be the nostalgia section. Like, you've got things like the Anvil of Torag, the Hell Knight Flail Incapacitator, the Almaday Crusader Helm. A lot of these are fairly interesting, sometimes high-powered magic items. Like, the earliest you can get anything on here is a weapon fusion you can get at level 3. But everything else starts significantly higher, especially the permanent items are like 5, and like 9 is when they start to look really cool. And, of course, the Ungatoro is a level 20 artifact that they detail in here.
I think it's hilarious that the only like super mega powerful artifact they still have of Galarian is this super technologically advanced gun. That's what I think of when I think of gold Galarian guns.
Right.
Curse now, you gunslingers.
And it's interesting, and it's nice to have this, because we've got to keep in mind, when this book launched, this was the only thing besides the core rulebook you had to pull things from, or the little mini alien book that came out for Free RPG Day before that. So, like I said, we were super starved for content. We didn't even have the Alien Archive yet when we were trying to play Starfinder games at this point.
Yeah, and it was rough because first contact's math didn't match what Alien Archives would be. So you had these monsters that were just really hard or really easy to kill, and like they were kind of buggy. Do you remember the one that has a sniper rifle that's like 1D100 by mistake or something?
1D120.
That's right, 1D120.
Yeah. Because typos are fantastic.
Typos sometimes are horrible, actually.
It was only like a CR3 or something. It was super low.
Yeah, it was a Sarkeesian. It was super low.
But speaking of aliens, the Alien Archives begin here, which is a running section that you'll see throughout all 6 of these volumes.
Right.
Which is a rather large... Honestly, this is very close to what we would have seen in the Alien Archive itself in format and display. Maybe not so much in this first release, but as we start to move through the volumes, they start to mirror like the really awesome format that we have praised Alien Archive for having.
Yeah, yeah. Also, it's worth noting that in this particular volume, most of the monsters actually do appear in the adventures. There are two exceptions, but I won't tell you which.
Right, right.
Dun, dun, dun.
Now, and we won't dig too much into the monsters themselves.
Yeah.
But you've got the Akata. He's in here, and he is later reprinted. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is like Robert McCreary's favorite monster ever. Yeah. Also, the special star metal that they make their cocoons out of, Noquil, appears in this book as well as a treasure, and it has stats, which is pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. That would also later be reprinted in Starfinder Omri. Yeah. I should know because I did that section.
The Drift Dead is also a reprint. So is the Bone Trooper. The rest seem to be relatively new, except for the Void Zombie. You need zombies. You need zombies. And my personal favorite, the Vrasina, which is this gigantic CR4 plant monster with too many mouths, because you can never go wrong without having too many mouths.
Listen, I think it's safe to say that in Starfinder, or in Pathfinder, there just weren't enough mouths on these plants. So they're making up for lost time and putting at least two mouths on every plant that you see.
Right.
That doesn't hold true in Alien Archive 2, guys. Don't type hate messages in the comments. I'm making a joke. It's just a joke. Seriously.
And then we end with the Codex of Worlds, which is just a random world that doesn't have anything to do with anything. It's just them really just sort of showing what craziness can be out there in space and give you some ideas. So this one, it is the Hikaron 5, which is a ocean planet with floating archipelago water cities and underwater cities.
And it shows like manta ray cities.
It looks like this like giant manta ray with like a whole bunch of cities on it. And hey, it's a water world. It's fun. Mm-hmm. And they will do these for each volume of the Adventure Path. There will be one of these random worlds, which is funny when we come up to another one. This particular one also eventually has a map of the Sunrise Maiden in the back, but that's more to tie into the Adventure Path because you need the ship you're going to be using.
Right. Also, the world in this one is fun because it's basically, hey, guess what? Space invaders came to this land and ruined everything. But we're the space invaders. We ruined everything. It's great. It's like real life. Hey, ready to jump into the next book?
But so far, this seems to be... Well, besides the fact that the Alien Archive section, the Alien Bestiary section... was extra large compared to a Pathfinder Adventure Path. So far, this is pretty typical to what I see in the back of a Pathfinder Adventure Path volume. You've got a location that ties into the adventure. You got a whole bunch of monsters, some magic items, and then some random stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Hey, look, it's Castrovel in the second volume, Temple of the Twelve by John Compton.
And I wonder why we're in Castrovel.
Nobody knows. There's no reason to be in Castrovel.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're not even allowed to be in Castrovel. Well, in certain areas of it.
Well, actually, when you go, you have to get your passport done, and then you have to get your passport done again to go to where the adventure actually is.
Yeah.
But in order to get to that point, there's like a racist brain and everything. It's great. This is a great book. It's funny.
And for those of you who do not know what a Castrovel is, it's one of the Pact Worlds. It is the...
second planet from the sun?
Right. And its importance is...
elves are from there?
Yes, this is why Pathfinder elves kind of look like aliens, especially in the first few early volumes in Elves of Galarian. You would look at the elves and be like, you don't look like you belong here. And the reason is, they don't!
Congratulations! It's great. That's the truth. They shouldn't be here. They just go. Also, they get really emo after the gap, and they just kind of retreat to their home continent of Sorivan. You don't see them, and if they go out, then you're a troublemaking young elf. Yeah, I mean, the Shunta are also from here too, like one of the actual core races. But I mean, elves are cool too, I guess. I don't know. This section is very similar to how Galarian's Gazetteer looks. It opens up with this really nice 2-page map spread. I think this one actually is reprinted in the Pact Worlds, but it's like shifted sideways, I think. And then there's just like a nice overview of different locations and places. It talks about like the different populations of the cities. There's a lot of information about like the Xunta and their arch enemies, the Formians, which is nice. It's kind of refreshing to see all of this information about things that aren't core races. It gives the world an actual alien feeling. There is some gorgeous art of what places on Kestrel look like. There's like tall buildings mixed with these really like nice small natural little vistas. It really makes the place feel like a world filled with hope and promise, and that isn't completely awful. So it's nice to have one of those in your setting.
Right. And also like the last piece of art we get to see, which is like this elven ranger with a rifle riding upon a giant weasel.
Yeah, no, but it's a four-eyed weasel with bug things for mouths.
Right. But still weasel, still gigantic, crazy weasel.
Yeah, I don't think they ever name what that creature is. I think they're just like, hey, put this elf on the strangest but coolest looking thing you can. And someone was like, I like weasels. Let me give it bug parts.
And again, I'm really impressed with the quality of the breakdown. They go a long way of presenting a lot of information about the planet so that you could definitely use this as a way to base any sort of campaign you wanted to on here. It's more than a lot of countries got in even like the Innersea World Guide before this came out. So this is a fairly significant chunk. This would be on par with a Pathfinder campaign setting 64 pager that usually would have like six different like that was a pattern of books. You would likely have like Cities of Galarian or Ruined Lost Cities of Galarian or Dungeons of Galarian, and you would have these like 10-page gazetteers that were like super detailed and really flavorful, and that is the format they're following here. And I like that they went with this. I like that they keep repeating it. The only dig is that this was super valuable when it came out, but this loses a little bit of its luster today because Pact Worlds came out, and Pact Worlds is awesome.
Totally. You know what else is awesome? Evil space cults are awesome.
No, they're terrible. They're terrible and murderous.
Oh, you don't want to say that to this guy. He's gonna devour you for saying that. One of the major themes in this book is the Cult of the Devourer, which is like the religious organization built around what is essentially Space Rovagug. I mean, he's called the Devourer. He's Space Rovagug.
And we just don't know where real Rovagug is.
I mean, the Devourer could be Space Rovagug for all we know. But regardless of whether or not that's true, this book talks a lot about this cult and its kind of like its secretive apocalyptic nature. There's a lot of really great art that gives a lot of different informations of like on the different cults of the Devourer and like what they do. It talks about the terrible things they do, the different sects of cultists, the important groups. There's this great picture of what I can only assume is a Vesk that ate a grenade and is about to explode. It's a really fun book overall, book section overall. But what's really cool about it is that it comes with player content.
If you wish to be an evil mystic, this is where you can get the Devastator Connection, which is the first expansion of a player option that saw print.
Yeah, it's great. It has a spell and it has a mystic connection, and it's a pretty darn good one, to be completely honest. Also, my favorite thing about this is that they took the time to make sure that we knew that Lashunta have varying body types, because we've got this really nice, like not super skinny supermodel Lashunta who isn't like super ripped. It's just this really great Lashunta. She's like, I'm gonna worship the Devourer. It's great. Enjoy it. It's overall it's a good mystic connection. I think that because it's called the Devastator and it's about breaking stuff, it's super associated with like devour, and like literally everyone listed is like this super evil god. So like you're not going to see this in play if your GM wants you to be good guys, but like your choices are chaotic neutral Azathoth, Demoritash, who is the Vesk god of war, who's lawful evil. You've got the Devourer, who's chaotic evil, Grotius, who's neutral evil, and Lamashtu, the demon mother, who is chaotic evil. So, I mean, I guess if you're going to play this and devastate everything, you've got to be a bad person.
It also is a melee focused theme for the Mystic, which we don't see a lot of. Like, it's actually been proven. Like, I've seen melee Mystics before. It's actually not a bad build. Good. It can be done very well. But this is like shattering defenses. So once per day as a standard action, you can reduce the DR energy resistance and target of a single target equal to your Mystic level for a number of rounds. You also have devastating critical. When you score a critical attack, you can spend a resolve point as a swift action to add the wound critical hit effect to your attack. You can do devastating frenzy, which lets you go into a destructive frenzy. This grants you a bonus to damage rolls with basic melee weapons and small arms. This is so interesting. And also, if you don't have a melee weapon on hand, don't worry about that. The new carnivorous spell will take care of you. It widens your mouth and gives you sharp teeth and gives you a natural bite attack, which does a d4 damage at start, but quickly grows up in damage into 10d8 damage at 20th level. So you always have that on tap whenever you need it.
And it's funny because it's very rare for first level spells to scale like that. As far as I know, this is the only spell that scales without making the spell level go up. So it's actually really good. Also, if you wanted more ways to rip things apart as a worshiper of the Devourer, don't worry. This book is the book for you because there's a whole section on Devourer-themed weapons and items. This includes the what I can only assume is Fallout New Vegas-inspired Pain Claw, which basically looks like one of those Death Claw weapons from Fallout, where like you cut off the Death Claw's hand and you wear it. You know what I'm talking about, Param? Mm-hmm. And it's an injector weapon. So like there's these little syringes on it, and when you stab people with the claw, it injects them with poisons and stuff for you. Our party's armored Solarian, who specializes in using like firearms and stuff, loved this book. Because one of the new weapons that got introduced were disintegrator weapons.
Yeah, we get to see more of these in the armory, but this is what introduced them. And oh my goodness, disintegration is always a fantastic option.
Yeah, and so what makes them so good is like there's a lot of fun when you attack with them because a lot of them roll really big dice for their damage. Mm-hmm. Specifically, they're most famous because a bunch of them use D20s as their damage dice. So yeah, it's like you're probably going to get a more consistent damage done from like rolling literally any other weapon. But when you roll that 20 on your D20 for you and you know it's your weapon damage, it feels so good. Mm-hmm. We actually beat a boss in Dead Sons last Saturday. And our armored Solarian was using her disintegrator rifle, and she actually crit with it and ended up rolling like all of these D20s, and like they one turned up a 19 and the other turned up an 18, and we all freaked out. It was great. This also has some really powerful weapon fusions that you can add to your weapon. Mm-hmm. They usually allow you to like shatter enemy defenses. They disintegrate your body if you get killed by the weapon. You get covered in armor spikes as an armor upgrade. But what's probably the most famous magic item out of this section is the Ring of Fangs, which is pretty much a must-have if you want to build a character around unarmed strikes. It makes your mouth grow really sharp fangs, and you basically get the Vesk's natural weapons trait. But with the big exception that instead of adding 1.5 times your level to damage, you add twice your level to damage. So even for a Vesk, it is an item that is a huge upgrade.
The next section is again more Alien Archives. We're going to have to skip through this one, but this is definitely where they started to really show off what would become the Alien Archive format that we see in the hardbacks. So you start seeing like the little race stat blocks. You see some of the player options introduced.
So there are a couple of new player races in this one. You have the Farron that are basically these super big, they're really into I think they're really into trade, if I remember right. They're actually detailed in the Gazetteer of Worlds section, like their home planet is in there. There's also this really cool, they kind of look like they're made out of stone, but they're not. They're really cool though. They're called the Wookitos, I think they're called. That's how you pronounce them. The Wioko, we'll go something like that, right? There's also that it's like got six legs. It's got a head that looks like an aardvark. It's covered in rocks for its back. I don't know what it is. Oh, it's also gargantuan, so it's like bigger than an elephant.
I just call this.
I don't know.
Elves have weird animals.
Elven husbandry.
Right.
There you go.
Then again, we have another Codex of World, which talks again about the Retherian, which is the Faerun home planet, and that's why they're all short and stocky. It's because it's a very high gravity home planet. And we use home planet with asterisk because it's actually a moon that is left over after the planet mass suicided into a black hole because of crazy reasons.
Yep.
All right, so moving on, we're gonna have to pick up the pace.
I know we're gonna have to because we're in Amanda Hammond Kunz's adventure now. We're in Splintered Worlds, which is a lot of stuff based on the Corpse Fleet and the Diaspora.
This is my favorite cover character, by the way, because it's this huge, round-headed alien that looks like it might have stepped right off of a Buck Rogers film set with this like most wicked looking Joker grin I've ever seen.
So like with Castrovel, we get this delightful two-page spread of the planet Eox where a good portion of the adventure takes place. You get to see just how absolutely destroyed and dead this planet is now. I think it might even be more dead than it was in Pathfinder, to be completely honest.
It looks like it's got like a chunk just straight bitten out of it. Like some, it's like Galactus just happened to stroll by and just like, oh, munch, 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 munch.
There's a 10-page gazetteer like there were with the other worlds we did. They also introduced a completely new type of augmentation in this book that would be reprinted and expanded upon in Armory, which are the necrographs. They are exactly what they sound like, and I think that Pathfinder had a version of them in Horror Adventures where you essentially take parts of undead creatures and you shove them into your body and hope for the best. I was going to say, there are things like, if you would like to build a bone blade into your arm, you can build a bone blade into your arm. You can replace your heart with a black, beating heart of death. You can have ghoul glands, so, like, you can basically, you hit people and, like, they get paralyzed. It's really cool. Also, it's really creepy, and I would never buy one. Don't do it, guys. You don't want to have undead things in your body.
Yeah, and this, I think almost all of these, if not all of these, were reprinted in Armory. So we already extolled on these before. But then we get what I consider actually very important, and we're going to get two of these. But we get the Corpse Fleet detailed in here.
Yeah.
So the Corpse Fleet is a running antagonist in the Starfinder Pact Worlds area. These are the Corpus that... when Eox decided to play nice with the Pact Worlds, they said no. And there's some controversy on did they really say no, or are they still working with Eox, and we don't really know. That's part of the fun. But these are the undead fleet out there that still preys upon the Pact Worlds fleets.
One of the things that's really important about this section is something that I think that I touched on when we talked about the different, like, not even just in Pact Worlds in general. If Starfinder has one thing that's tricky about its setting is that the setting doesn't do a great job of telling you who the antagonists are and who are causing problems unless they're the focus of an adventure path already. So having this right up of the Corpse Fleet and making sure we know that they are huge antagonists to the setting is really important, in my opinion.
And it does. You get 6 pages of detailing the politics and internal structure of the Corpse Fleet, which is super useful if you're going to go all space opera with them. There's a lot of heavy space opera feeling with the fleet sections of these books. Then you get some necrotech weapons, because if the Corpse Fleet are going to shoot you, they're going to shoot you with undead guns, because of course they are.
Yeah. And a lot of these weapons have a new special property called necrotic. Basically, the necrotic weapons attacks deal cold damage, but that cold damage is infused with negative energy. So if you are immune to cold damage, then basically the cold damage only works on living creatures, and anything that is immune to cold damage is, or anything that's immune to the negative energy is also immune to the cold damage. So you really can't shoot an undead creature with these weapons. It sort of makes them really scary when you think about, because the corpse fleet can basically go in armed with all of these weapons, and they don't care if they shoot their allies, because their allies aren't hurt by these. It's literally designed only to wreak havoc upon the bodily systems of the living, which is rather terrifying. We get things like hand claws, where like they can slash you and it does this energy. There are dueling swords that are specifically designed for the corpse fleet instead of the base dueling swords we see in the book. Like, they're higher item levels and at different levels than what is in the core rulebook. I believe all of those got reprinted in Armory 2, but I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. There are also the frailty pistols and rifles. There's a hand cannon. It's pretty great. Mm-hmm.
The Vanguard of the Corpse Fleet is detailed next, which is a selection of Corpse Fleet vessels, because if you're going to go up against a fleet, you need to have your spaceship battles with them. Yeah. It goes from Tier 1 to Tier 7. The biggest thing on here is the Destroyer class ships. Mm-hmm. So not a lot of high-level Corpse Fleet, so not something to be super scared of. And then we open into the Alien Archive section. The big call-outs here I want to call out is the Elebrians are detailed here, which is what the Eoxians were before they decided to go undead, because there's still a little bit of those still left in the planet.
There's a very, undead. Very small number. For the most part, you usually see Elebrian as something that is templated into another type of undead.
And then the final thing I want to call out is the Jiangshi vampires, which I am super glad exist in this setting. They are the hopping vampires, the Asian hopping vampires. And he has a little holographic scroll in front of his face instead of the traditional paper scroll. And it is wonderful art, a wonderful rendition of this creature. It's a template graft, but they do have a pre-made one here for you to enjoy as a CR6 critter. I giggled when I read this, so I was very happy.
Let me tell you, the Morrow Blight is mean and nasty. You fight it in either an Adventure Path or a Starfinder Society scenario, and it's not fun. It will murder you.
There's just too many claws to put on something that looks like it could arm wrestle the Hulk.
Yeah, for reference, it looks like a dude, right? Just like a fleshy, naked dude. But like its back has 8 spider limbs, but all the spider limbs, instead of having legs, they're all like knives. Like bony, horrible knives.
Right. It looks like it belongs in a Clive Barker movie.
Yes. Right. In addition to those, we also get a bit about Barrow, which is a vast moon/planet that's like located outside of the system where the corpse fleet dock. You know, you're kicked out of the Pact Worlds, therefore you got to go somewhere, and this is kind of where they hang out now.
Next up, and then we're going to move on to Dead Sons, Volume 4? Volume 4 by Ruined Jason Clouds. Keeley.
Keeley!
We'll have to, next time get Keeley's on the show, we'll need to talk to him about this.
Yeah, totally. Uh-huh. So this is the book we just finished. Wow. This brings back some memories already. So the one thing that's interesting about this book is that this book does not deal a planet in the Pact Worlds, because it doesn't take place in the Pact Worlds. It takes place on a completely alien area, and the book actually gives a lot of information about the planet of Istamic, which is the major setting throughout this adventure.
This is also where they're going to begin a odd pattern of having a whole lot of flying islands in the back matter, because Istamek is the first one we see, and they will have a unusually large proportion of floating islands in the planets they'll detail coming up.
Mm-hmm. So this book is weird because I guess this is a minor spoiler, so skip ahead like 5 seconds if you don't want to hear it, starting now. There's a lot of archaic weapons in this book because they get used frequently.
Okay.
Yeah. So archaic items are going to be things that you don't really use as a player ever, because they automatically deal 5 less damage against anything wearing like actual armor. Mm-hmm. So, be aware of that. But there's also a lot of really cool magic items in this book. One of them is this magical like sash you wear across your body. And if where you're wearing it, you get either cold resistance or fire resistance. And if you're an armored Solarian, it stacks with the resistance that your Solarian armor gives, mm-hmm. which is really helpful to a class option that does not have a lot of support and really needs it.
Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of items in here.
Yeah.
It's called the Kish equipment section. Then you go into the Gazetteer section here. That follows is, well, how would we describe the next section? It talks about the drift here.
Yeah.
So we
find... it's kind of like one of the plane write-ups in Planar Adventures for Pathfinder.
Mm-hmm. So the drift is not just this giant hyperspace place that has a lot of pretty technicolors and nothing of note in it. It has places. Things in it. It's a plane with places. It's hard for me to call it its own native places because most of the stuff that's in the drift is stuff that is just like sort of stolen from other planes every time somebody travels through it. So there's little bits of the hells in here. There's little bits of heaven. There's little bits of the various places on the prime planes. It's odd, but there are cities and planets and societies that live in the drift full time. And it's worth noting that in the drift, teleportation magic works as long as you're only going from place to place in the drift, but you can't teleport in and out, and you can't summon anything. A lot of the standard magic trappings just don't work here. Also, there's no gravity.
Yes. Which is very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, also, it's neutrally aligned. Yeah. That's a weird concept.
Especially considering that it's a plane that's like supposed to be part of the material plane. The general consensus is that it might be neutrally aligned because Triune is so heavily associated with it, but nobody really knows for sure. And most of the write-up paints the fact that like nobody knows much about the drift. So,
hey, but if you wanted to ask Triune, you can do so at Alluvian.
Yeah, it's a city in the drift.
Yeah, and Triune lives there.
Yeah, look at that. Look at that great city. It's got a giant one-page map. This is Alluvian.
Yeah, and it's a floating city island in the middle of the drift.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. This book is really great if you've ever wanted to know more about the drift, which I think is a necessity considering how important it is to the Starfinder in general. If you're playing mm-hmm. in Starfinder, I feel like this volume is mandatory for now just because of how much it extrapolates on the drift.
Right. In the archives, alien archives section, the only one I want to call out this time is the living holograms, because so having evil AI holograms, cool. It's interesting that Starfinder went ahead and took the jump that, you know, if holograms ever were to become sentient AI, they'd probably be evil.
Oh, you have no idea. You fight some in this adventure and it's awful.
Spoilers.
Sorry, that was spoilers.
Yeah.
Also, this thing is terrifying. Don't get stuck in a hallway with it.
It's just... a CR8 critter. And if it's just a hologram, how do you fight it? It can just be anywhere it wants to be.
That would be spoilers, so I can't say how you fight them.
So spoilers.
Spoilers. I'm so sorry, guys. I promised you I wouldn't spoil any Dead Sons for you, and here I am spoiling Dead Sons for you.
And then we get to Codex of Worlds, and I'm only calling this one out because Najori 6, which is floating island planet.
Listen, Jason Keeley clearly likes his floating islands. We'll have to ask him about that next time he's on.
Indeed.
Although, if we're being real, like, so we don't know who wrote in the first book, mm-hmm. but at the end of each other book, it tells you who writes the sections in the next upcoming book.
Mm-hmm.
So we could totally look it up, but we don't have time. Let's continue on to book 5.
Right.
Also, I want to call out the jellyfish on the back that we'll be seeing again. Here's a jellyfish with a gun. Just in case, I feel like this encapsulates what Starfinder is. Jellyfish with a gun.
Cryptwalker asked if the living holograms equal Voyager's EMH. Yes, but if he was more evil than he is.
Yeah. It's like if you gave Hal 4000 a holographic body that he can move anywhere he wanted. Mm-hmm. That's basically what they are.
Indeed.
Enjoy that motion. Let it lull you to sleep tonight.
This is the first of the back matters that doesn't begin with the gazetteer section. It goes straight into Relics of the Kishle, which is an item chapter talking about weapons and armor.
Yeah, it's super cool. Also, I won't be able to spoil anything from this. We haven't started this book yet.
Oh man, so the big coolest thing here is that they have hover bikes, and if you're going to have hover bikes, you're automatically more awesome than anyone else.
Yeah, I also like temporal distortion as a weapon fusion. And when you crit someone, it stuns them because you push them out of time. It's hilarious, and it's a really great way to use to flavor the stun mechanic. I'm a big fan of that.
And here we get a what. Then we get to what would have been a gazetteer, but we get the section called Alien Worlds and Cultures, which is basically the little planet section that we've been talking about. It's been in each book, but it's like a whole section of planets. So you got like Archelon, the marsh world of poisonous clouds, where they have these giant, the planet has these gigantic starship parts that crashed into it, and the society just sort of grew up and developed into an advanced society with those already there. So they're just part of the mountain ranges. There's our broken half of a star fortress, and that city that we built on top of it.
Totally.
And then
You got to.
you have it, Eletrio, which is super important for Pathfinder Society players. This details all the things there is Eletrio, but if you're a Pathfinder Society player, maybe don't read this one yet until you've played the adventures, because it spoils the crap out of those adventures.
Yeah. I'm trying not to read it, but my eyes are just scanning all over. It's like that episode of SpongeBob where he's like, hee-hee, and his eyes get big and just start rubbing all over the pages. That's me right now. Spoilers ahead, folks.
Let me get
Go ahead.
And then we get Silcerek because we need more floating islands.
But Primoria, it's the land of sentient invertebrates. Look
I
at
know.
the mushroom houses.
It's the. I know. We need more mushroom and oozes in the world.
It's Sporgar from World of Warcraft. It's Sporgar, but they have technology. It's
In
great.
the alien section, we get mushroom people with rifles called the Cicerobands. We also get the Gibraani, which are again a race that's super important for society players,
Woo!
or a species. Sorry, I need to update my terminology.
I like Snake Man with snakes for hair. Like, there's something about just there's too many snakes on this creature. It's got too many heads and too many snakes. I like how it's got an ability called Redundant Vitals. That's hilarious. Yes, all of those snake heads are very redundant. So are all the eyes on them.
And their next volume is going to be Empire of Bones by Owen K.C. Stevens, who also did the Ships of the Line article in here, because I'm totally cheating and using Alex's tip that they give the authors here.
Oh yeah, it's also on the front. You can tell exactly who did what. I'm really excited to talk about Ships of the Corpse Fleet because there's something in this book that I've wanted, and it exists because of this book. And I think this is the other volume of Dead Sons that's mandatory for building your campaigns.
Let's see here. All right, so let's go ahead and flip on ahead, which is sh it starts with Ships of the Line, and I'm super okay. So whoever wrote this, which was Owen K.C. Stevens, must love space opera, and
Oh,
because the
it's Owen, yeah.
concepts of the Ships of the Line is like mega important in space opera talk. Because when you have empires that are going to war with each other, they're going to throw all their resources into gigantic super ships and line those suckers up to go to war with, and present this one huge line of battle. If you've ever read like the Honor Harrington series, they go into details why that's an effective tactic in space battles. You're going to see a lot of that in like the Harlock animes, or Battle of the Stars is going to have a ton of that too. So a lot of very classic space opera is involved in these like pseudo navy tactics, and
Right.
just like ships the size of
And
cities.
And as a result, that this book introduces the super colossal starship frame, which is for starships that are more than 6 miles long, mm-hmm. and they at least weigh 2,000 megatons, which I think is 1,000 tons.
And to put this into perspective, Absalom Station would not be big enough to qualify as an ultronaut.
No, it wouldn't. It's not big enough. Absalom Station is smaller than these battleships, which really puts it in perspective. But at the same time, these places aren't designed to be livable the way that Absalom Station is. You can tell because both ships that are presented here, the base ship and the Ultronaut, have maximum crews that are far less than even 1 million people. Mm-hmm. The base super colossal ship, like it's literally a starship base, is 100,000 people, where the Ultronaut can only support a maximum of 5,000 people at its size. So like these are not for living, these are for killing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you need room for the guns the size of small neighborhoods.
I know. And then so like this book introduced things like power cores that are sized for ships this big. It shows like different computer modules. It includes rules for like different types of drift engines that it uses and a special expansion bays. Like there's a recycling system that lets the super colossal ship be self-sustaining, mm-hmm. Which is how great. I love that. Mm-hmm. Give me more flavorful ones.
And I like how it mentions that the expansion bays in the ship of this size is not just a giant room or just a tiny room in the ship. When you add an expansion bay, it's like, no, this is like if you add a medical bay to this is not a medical bay. It's like a whole bunch of medical bays spread throughout the whole ship because you added that capacity to the ship.
Because you need enough medical bays to support that giant population that the ship can carry.
I mean, if you're working on the rear engine and you get your foot bashed in and broken, you don't want to have to wait 6 miles in an elevator to get some medical care.
This is what you'd also use for the Castle of Lions, in my opinion, and from Voltron Legendary Defenders. Yeah, you think so? No?
I don't think it's big enough.
So you think that the super colossal is too small? Or the
Castle of Lions? The Castle of Lions isn't big enough.
I could see that. Mm-hmm. At the very least, it's one of those giant Gaara ships.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like, if you were a Warhammer fan, this would be their big cathedral ships.
Yeah. But there are cathedral ships in this game, too, for Iomede.
Mm-hmm.
Also, speaking of more starships, just in case you didn't have enough, in addition to Owen's section on super colossal starships, there is a Starships of the Corpse Fleet section written by Jason Keeley. And in that section, we get a whole bunch of new weapons, we get new expansion bays, we get a whole bunch of new just models and types of starships. Like, there's one that is basically giant whale head thing, like the greatest of starships. Look at this whale head thing. It's like a giant circle with bones and horrible looking eyes. I like the one that is so darkly colored that it is barely visible against the vacuum of space.
Well, it's called the Spectre for a reason.
Yes, that's why. And then if you go to the next the next page, there's even more. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, look at all this art for these crazy ships.
Yeah.
Then you get the archives.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. So
between this and the other one, you have a humongous amount of corpse fleet that you can throw at things.
So much.
I like that the Bicocks are in, future sci-fi Bicocks kind of, like, makes me giggle because to see this monster sci-fied up is not one I ever thought would come to the table.
Yeah, totally.
And this bestiary section, or the alien archive section here, is a whole lot of undead with the exception of the Shimreen, which is a new race they introduce here, which is if you want to be a living crystal person that has crystal swords.
For arms.
You can be one.
I mean, like, that's super cool, and I really like that monster too. However, I would like to point out that this volume introduces undead versions of races that are not Yosoki or humans, which is great because you never see things that aren't humans, and Starfinder Alien Archives does a lot of undead rat folk for some reason. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of undead rat folk. Yeah. But in this one we get the Gatecrasher that's shown by this giant meaty Vesk, and he's like got horrible tumors all over his body and his organs are popping out, but man oh man is he ready to crash some gates.
He's also got that big two-handed hammer that has the rocket engine on the back of it, which fantastic weapon.
He's Reinhardt with a gun, and that's why he died, because he didn't have a shield.
Who needs a shield when you're an undead Vesk?
I mean, he did. He wouldn't be undead if he had a shield. That's the point, Perrin. Also, we have the other not human, not Yosoki, not Vesk undead, which is this delightful pale stranger Kasatha. I love it. Pale Stranger was an undead introduced in Pathfinder. It was basically a gunslinging undead abomination. Mm-hmm. And this version does not disappoint. It is a gunslinging undead abomination. If you've ever wanted to see an undead with four arms and just as many guns shoot somebody down, use this monster, please.
It also mentions that the Pale Strangers are likely to use archaic weapons.
Yeah. Very fun, because they're so cool. They will always carry one or more small arms, with the oldest of them using our weapons from a bygone era. And then to wrap up the Codex of Worlds, there's the new Shimmerin Sarah? I don't know. Give up. Done.
Okay.
Hey, guess what? A year on this planet takes 540 days, which is cool. It's a little bit. It's about a year and a half of our time.
Which would be great if it wasn't constantly covered in horrific storms.
I mean, that's a general theme with the worlds in this book, though, isn't it? This place would be great if everything wasn't bad.
And that bring okay. That's all the that's a good survey of the content that exists in the back matter. Overall, what were your thoughts on the back matter serving the purpose of being the player's guide and campaign setting books for Starfinder?
It's not enough.
No, it's not. I mean, the sections here are usually fleshed out a lot more than their Pathfinder equivalents in the Adventure Paths. Like the 10-page gazetteers definitely kind of just like gives me a taste of what would be in a campaign setting book. And the writing is fantastic. It's all put together well. And the item sections are about on par with what we would see in the Pathfinder equivalent. And I know our audience gets critical when we super compare to Pathfinder, but we have to look at that to see if we're really getting what they said we were getting here.
Yeah,
if we were getting this to serve the purpose of being the replacement, or at least a small supplemental version of the content of the lines they decided not to do for this game. And so for the campaign setting information, we're definitely getting a lot more than we're used to. As far as the player and the aliens, we're getting a whole lot more aliens than we're used to. Though I'm interested to see how that's going to change with the next upcoming adventure paths. So I'll have to look ahead there, and then I'll get back to you all with my findings there. But besides those two sections, which are definitely beefy, what we got here is just kind of on par with what we would have expected for being in the back matter. And so much of it, especially in those first few, tie in really strongly with the AP, that it's really mostly serving the AP, not so much outside audiences.
Well, wait, though. Like, as someone who's played through Dead Sons, none of the stuff in the Relics of Galarian section in the first volume actually show up or is important. Like, to me, the first volume is the only one that feels like it even tried to be a player companion because it put in stuff. But, like, when you look through across all of these volumes, they all focus on magic items, hybrid items. They focus on starships for that GMs are going to use and starship items. For like, except for the new equipment, like this, there isn't much, and the new races, which may or may not ever, you know, be usable by players. There isn't a whole lot that makes this feel like a player is going to want to pick this up, in my opinion. I think that they tried to cut the line where, like, oh, let's put some player content and let's put some GM content. But, like, it doesn't really end up serving enough of either side, I think. I wish that instead of what we got, this book line was like, okay, well, we're going to put the Pathfinder campaign setting guides exclusively in this book. Right. So things that you would expect to serve to a GM are what's in here. And, yeah, that's going to make the book less attractive to players, sure. But I think the overall quality of the content would be improved. I think that Starfinder as a game would still benefit from a player companion line, because these books are not scratching that itch. Out of all six volumes, and like, this is not looking ahead, of course. Maybe they fix this in future adventure paths. But looking at these six volumes, the only new player option you got was a Mystic connection that is for evil characters only, which might as well be you can play it if you want, but we don't really intend you to play this, which is kind of what designers say when they give you evil content. So I think that this, I think the content is good, don't get me wrong, but I don't think that it meets the goal of trying to make good for the campaign setting and player companion lines. And that's not even getting into the fact that it's about what, 12, 30 page, 32 pages shorter. Does that sound about right?
Sounds yes.
Yeah. It's about 32 pages shorter than a regular Pathfinder book would be. If we got those 32 pages and there was more content in these books, I could see it, but there's not. And it kind of helps me understand why there's kind of a perception among the Starfinder community that Starfinder products are pretty, but content-wise, they aren't worth the same amount as Pathfinder, that like they don't hit that same like value, I guess you could say, which is a criticism I've seen throughout the community.
I think that it does a okay job of being a campaign setting books because this very much mirrors a lot of what we'd see in the campaign setting book. The gazetteers, the monsters that would appear on those planets, so some of the other information kind of feels like it was looks like it's very much patterned off that of Galarian campaign setting books, like the stop the blank of Galarian line. We saw a lot of that modeled here. So if they were saying that this is kind of filling that gap, I buy it. It because it really the quality of information is there. It's definitely very GM focused as those books are. This, but you're right. There's like a couple of magic items in every book that usually ties in really strongly with what I'm assuming are the races. Sorry, the species that appear in the adventure path that you're going to be up against. And the one player option, in throughout the entire thing, that mystic. So it does not, you're right, it does not do the player companion at all.
Now,
And they do give a percentage of the book. This is much more than an AP got, because the adventures in these books cut off at page 38. Whereas the Pathfinder adventures would go significantly longer. So you're getting a little over half of this book is the back matter. So you are getting more there. So there's more back matter here. And arguably, there's more back matter here than even total pages of back matter in a Pathfinder AP. But at the
Definitely.
cost of the adventures being shorter is what that seems to be where the real cut
Yeah.
was made.
Which is okay because I think the adventures at the length they are, they're really fun and it feels good to move through them quickly, like I said. But I think that the content in here doesn't really hit the mark between GM and player very well, and it doesn't really include a whole lot of like it doesn't include the toys for players to play with. It's races which are kind of regimented and like new magic items. So, but now that being said, I wouldn't expect this book to kind of fix that about it. Just because Dead Sons came out at a really slow pace compared to most Pathfinder products, by the time Dead Sons came out every other month for its entire run, and it wasn't until the Aeon Adventure book, the next one, Aeon Throne, that they went to a monthly pattern, which would have sped up their development and their outlining cycle. So personally, I would expect to see the content be better starting in Signals of Screams, just because by the time they were working on, by the time the first volume of Dead Sons came out, they were probably working on volume 4 or 5 of Dead Sons based on that development cycle, which means the outline for up to 6 was already done, and there's a good chance that they didn't get like good feedback from having multiple volumes done until the Aeon Throne was already, outlined and going to freelancers. So I would expect to start see to see whether or not like they become a little bit better balanced starting with Signal of Screams. And I think if Signal of Screams doesn't have that balance, then there's more of an issue with how these are being laid out because they're definitely not, they wouldn't be hitting the niche that they were advertised as filling at that point. Does that make sense?
Indeed. So my final thoughts on this are going to be if you are a game master and you're collecting these adventure paths, which I know a significant number of game masters do subscribe to the line and collect it, you do not skip the back matter content. Pay attention to it. There's some real gem content in there, some really high quality stuff. And as a game master, you're going to get a lot of mileage on it. And a lot of it will make for some fantastic player handouts. It would be great to hand out some of this information to your players about Absalom Station specifically, about Eox, about Castorval. But if you're a player, I can't recommend you buying these books for the content that's in there. If you're a GM and going to get the adventures anyway, which and buying adventures are great, even whether or not you intend to run them, because you can always mine them for material, because there's all kinds of cool things like encounters and NPCs and monsters and maps that you can use for your own stuff. So it's always great as a GM to buy adventures. But I know a lot of Pathfinder fans skip the back matter content in the APs. Don't make that mistake with Starfinder.
No, not
at
all.
The stuff that is there is great, but it isn't worth buying the book for.
Yes. I think that's an apt summary. If you were already going to buy the adventure or you want to know more about the setting, you should pick it up. If you weren't going to buy the adventure and you are creative enough that you don't need that content, and if you're a player who's mostly playing in Starfinder, it's probably a safe skip. Archives of Nethys has most of it for free, and they partner with Paizo now. So, I mean, if you want to pick it up because you want to support them and you see something you like in it, that's what I mean, I have all of them. So, So I am one to say, like, yo, if you want to just support Paizo, then do it. But if you're looking for your money's worth in content, you're better off, like, saving up and buying a book like The Armory or one of the Alien Archives. Even, like, the Alien Archives are way better player than the AP.
And a lot of this content that would have been player focused ended up being reprinted in the Armory. So,
yeah,
there's that.
A lot.
Yeah.
Like pretty much the entire Necrograph section.
All right.
Actually, hilarious enough, Ring of Fangs didn't make it in, and it's basically mandatory for natural attack builds.
That's because it should be banned.
Should it really?
No, I don't know. I don't care. I don't think it's that bad. Melee is so hurting in Starfinder. Melee is kind of hurting.
Oh, that's not true. I beat stuff up. It's great.
Yeah, but then you die so quickly.
I mean, if I die, that's on me for my playing. I didn't kill it fast enough.
Well, in my experience, melee players die really fast in Starfinder.
Because they're not playing.
They scare things, and then things that are scared tend to shoot them and focus their fire on them.
That's why you destroy them with swords, Param.
Right, right. Destroy with swords. And have big, heavy armor.
No, yeah, it's good. That's what you do. You don't go in there wearing no armor. You got to go in there with the armor. Be a soldier. Take the guard style. Grab armored advantage. Have the best AC this side of the galaxy. You'll love it, and they'll hate you. They'll really hate you. But that's for another topic for another day.
All right. So before we go, if you wish to check out this content or any of our other content, you can do so at NoDirectionPodcast.com, where you can find our fantastic Discord community. There's a link there right on to the right, and you'll find the chillest, most awesome place to talk about Pathfinder, Starfinder, Paizo content, and random stuff with us, the hosts and bloggers of No Direction, as well as the No Direction fans out there. Y'all are awesome. We love talking with you all throughout the week. It's also a good place to ask us questions or suggest topics for shows. We also wish to thank our Patreon patrons, because without you, this expansion of content of the No Direction Network could not be possible. We appreciate all of you. And if you wish to become a patron of the No Direction Network, you can again find the link to our Patreon at NoDirectionPodcast.com. And
hey, while you're there, check out our blog content.
Oh, yeah, our blog content. It's all sorts of awesome. There's lots of Starfinder content, lots of Pathfinder content on there, a lot of system neutral stuff. We got some fantastic writers with impeccable pedigrees providing content every single day, except for Saturday and Sunday. And we're kind of running out of days to cram in more content, so maybe some Saturdays and Sundays. We don't know.
Oh, listen,
we're running out of days.
If we're doing content on Saturday and Sundays, you're writing it, Param. I am not writing more content for Saturdays and Sundays.
No. That's why we recruit more writers.
Oh, I guess that's a good point. We could just hire
people. Alex, you don't have to write every section. I mean, you write more than anybody else, but you don't have to write every section.
Good. I'm glad somebody realizes this. All right. No, but Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great stuff. Oh, also, by the way, if you want to see me and Parham get up to even more shenanigans, you can check out the No Direction Network's newest actual play podcast, Seasons Beatings, where I run an adventure that I wrote called Yuletide Terror for Jefferson J. Thacker. That's him. Also for Vanessa Hoskins and Louise Loza, our staff Muscle Wizard, and also Jason Keeley, who we keep talking about on No Direction Beyond. You can watch them struggle through a wonderful Christmas adventure filled with all sorts of wonderful Christmas monsters and also lots of things that they were not expecting. It's great. You just want to listen to how scared and confused and bewildered they get at the crazy things that I throw at them. It's really fun.
Oh, and one last special thing we want to announce. If you've been missing Adventurous, our actual play War for the Crown with GM Crystal Frazier, you do not have to miss it much longer. This upcoming Saturday, we will be doing another live recording of Adventurous, and then of course the podcast will trickle out from there. So Adventurous comes back on Saturday. And I get to reprise my role as Glandrill.
And I get to reprise my role as having a weekend off.
No, you don't. We've got that other thing we got to record.
Oh, gosh, no. I forgot about
that. You get no time off, Agunis. If I don't get time off, you don't.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm being pulled into his madness, everybody. Oh,
it is no joke. I will be playing something like 20 hours of Pathfinder this weekend.
That sounds wonderful.
It is wonderful, but it's a lot of Pathfinder.
That's a lot of Pathfinder. Just look on the bright side. You get a nice break from getting beaten up by Krampus.
Oh, instead, my good lord. Get beat up Krampus by... is going to beat the crap out of me.
Instead, you get to get beaten up by the entire nation of Tal'Dor. Enjoy. Literally, they're all just going to line up one at a time and be like, it's my turn now to beat up the halfling, please.
Well, that is kind of sort of how that last episode cliffhanger went.
Oh, no, it was a great cliffhanger.
Oh, no. I'd be so glad to get back to that. We were having a fantastic time. Crystal Frazier, if you've not heard her GM, she is amazing at characters. She can, like, run, like, five or six different characters talking amongst themselves, and the NPCs have distinct voices and personalities, and I'm in awe. I am constantly learning new techniques just from her skill.
She does completely exude brilliance, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Much like the crazy but brilliant silliness that comes from your mad creations.
I don't think it's quite at the same level, but I do think that it's a very different type of listen. Mm-hmm. I feel like, as someone who's heard a bit of Adventurous and who runs Yuletide Terror, like, Adventurous is like your Game of Thrones, and like Yuletide Terror is your Dark Monty Python, I guess.
I was thinking like season 14 Simpsons Christmas special.
Huh, I've never seen that one.
Well, I haven't either, but I was thinking late season Simpsons.
Oh, but that's not good. Late season Simpsons isn't good.
It's not terrible.
Okay. I don't know how I feel about being compared to something that's not terrible, but I guess I'll take it.
No, it's a blast, guys. You should totally listen to it, y'all.
Listen, no. At the end of the first episode, I get them real good with a surprise, and it's totally worth watching the first two episodes just so you can see them react to it. It's great. I'm so excited.
And make sure, if you can, get to the website and look at least the episode thumbnails for the first one and then the second one. Specifically, pay attention to my big, beefy Nordic fighter barbarian and Jason Keeley's old, wise, wizened worshiper of Odin and punisher of evil.
No, listen, you have no idea how hard it was to keep that a secret for the month while we were working up on it.
Well, let's
it
not
was
spoil so it for our listeners. Go okay. Watch episode one, if nothing else. You'll have a blast.
It's fun.
All right, later, everyone.
Have a great night. Go beyond.
With No Direction.